Good morning, Prince George. Well, not actually a good morning, not after the American elections yesterday, but good morning, what the hell. This is Uncle Don with Uncle Don Reads the Comics. Today's the 6th of November, and this is CFUR 88.7 FM in Prince George. Welcome aboard for a half-hour guided tour through our mad world. Hang on. The death of the Caribou Prospector. The provincial government has finally given the coup de grace to the passenger rail service that has linked North Vancouver with Prince George for almost half a century. After the huge gift that Campbell gave to his supporters in the form of tax cuts to the rich, there's not enough money to finance a service that lost $10 million a year, or $5 million, or something. It seems that there were conflicting estimates coming from different party officials. The cost of replacing the self-propelled bud cars was to be $25 to $30 million, which BC Rail claimed it could not pay. Better to cut this service, which would be an unwarranted drain on the provincial government. Enter Omnitrax, the American operator of short-line rail services on both sides of the border. According to an article in the Free Press of 31 October, Omnitrax thinks they can make money on the passenger service. What's the magic? Well, they say that the current bud cars can be renovated for $1 million each, and they could keep them running for 20 years. The question arises, as it always does in these cases, as to how the private sector can run a service that the government cannot afford. The government cannot run it at cost. How can private operators provide the service and add a profit into the mix? We know from the scandals of Arthur Anderson Accounting that there are lots of ways to manipulate accounts of a business to show almost any profit or loss that the client wishes. In this case, the provincial government first made the decision to eliminate the Caribou Prospector, and then a case was made for the decision. This is akin to the way the Fraser Institute does its studies. First, it determines what the right-wing sponsors want as a conclusion, then it works backwards with its supposed studies to rationalize that conclusion. I have questions as to how the supposed loss on the passenger service was determined. Did the government charge the passenger service with a disproportionate share of BC Rail's right-of-way maintenance? The bud cars certainly caused less wear and tear than freight trains. Did they allocate interest costs on BC Rail's borrowed money? Did they offset the cost of transporting by rail with the public cost of these same passengers driving, flying, or taking the bus? All of those cost the government in road maintenance or airport operation, air pollution, and the other various expenses of maintaining infrastructure. Behind the shucking of government responsibility for rail travel lies another goal. The government has just eliminated a number of good union jobs that will be replaced with low-wage non-union jobs if an operator like Omnitrax takes over the route. This rail service has not just been a tourist service. Many people have been using this for basic transportation to and from the small settlements along the railway. Now some of them are left without any transportation that is reasonable, reliable, or affordable. But that's all right. They probably did not vote Liberal anyway. If Omnitrax or another private company takes over passenger rail service, there is no guarantee that it will serve communities. If it is run purely for profit, it may just cater to tourists, running at odd times and with high ticket prices. Why should they care about local citizens? This discontinuation of a service that has been thought to be essential service by all governments of BC for almost half a century is outrageous. Is anyone keeping a scorecard on the damage that this government is doing to this province? Campbell has even angered the Northerners who backed him as he pursues his corporate agenda while spiting all of the province outside of the 604 area code. Let Campbell's next deep cut be made just above his collar line. Bush's crusade against the world. Bush Light is still pushing for his war against Iraq, come hell or high water. With or without the approval of the permanent members of the Security Council, he wants Hussein's head on a platter. "He tried to kill my daddy," says Baby Bush, "so a couple of 100,000 Iraqis should pay the ultimate price for an unproven allegation made by a pathological liar." Even if Bush should con or bribe the members of the United Nations Security Council who have a veto, namely Britain, France, China, and Russia, to endorse his planned attack, what right have the politicians of these countries to give permission for the United States to make a blatant attack on a sovereign country? It would still violate the UN Charter, which is supposed to be the supreme international law. In the aftermath of the heroic American bombing and massacres in Afghanistan, that country is in a mess with the returned refugees starving, the drug trade revived, and the warlords back in charge. So what does Bush have planned for Iraq? With the country only held together by the forces of Saddam Hussein's government, it looks like it could split into three pieces between the Sunni Muslims, the Shiite Muslims, and the Kurds. If Bush wants to hold the wreckage of the country together, he will have to occupy it with a huge number of American soldiers. He doesn't want to do that, as that would lead to massive expenses and returning body bags. Of course, the expenses could be covered by the oil that his corporate friends intend to steal from the Iraqi people. But holding this country together will be quite a feat. The Kurds cannot be allowed to get their own territory, Kurdistan, that they have been promised since World War I. That would frighten the Turks, who have a sizable Kurdish minority that is only kept in check through a barbaric military occupation. And then there are the Shiite Muslims, who might opt to go with their brothers in Iran. This would shift their territory from one member of the Axis of Evil to another. What are the American plans for reconstruction in a post-war Iraq? Does Baby Bush have any plans that would not deteriorate into a Middle East meltdown? Should the world, and specifically Canada, follow the United States into a mess that could descend into the clash of civilizations that we have heard postulated? The United States has grabbed a hold of a whole bag of snakes in the Middle East, and it threatens to get out of hand in a real hurry. Now let us hope that our fearless Chrétien can be persuaded to keep his damned mouth shut and not commit Canada to becoming an accomplice to this whole mess. There won't be any winners in this battle. And then there's Britain's pathetic little lickspittle Tony Blair. In September, Blair issued a dossier on Iraq that is and its supposed threat to the free world. He claimed that Saddam Hussein has continued to arm himself with weapons of mass destruction in spite of a decade of a quarantine and weapons inspections which supposedly dismantled over 90% of Iraq's military capacity. If this dossier is taken at face value, the West is faced with a formidable adversary which presents a clear and present danger to us all. But let us look at another side of this document and its supposed revelations. The blockade of Iraq has cost as many as 1 million children's lives due to diseases and malnutrition. This is a figure that has come from United Nations studies and other impartial observers. Now, if the blockade has had no effect on the development of weapons of mass destruction, as Blair alleges, the whole blockade exercise has been worthless. You see where I'm going? If the blockade has been worthless, supposedly the wise men who run our intelligence services and their governments must have known that these children are dying for no good reason. No one has claimed that these children were responsible for Saddam Hussein or his crimes. If this blockade was maintained by men who knew that it was ineffective, then the death of these children was a war crime of massive proportions. Think about it. On a related issue, one of the rationalizations that Bush Light is using to push his coming war against Iraq is that it might be planning to distribute weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. A recent newspaper article reported that the U.S. General Accounting Office has found that hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons given to friendly countries since 1993 cannot be accounted for. These transfers have been made by presidents under congressional authority that allows presidents to give aid to other countries to meet emergencies, fight drug trafficking, or for other needs as determined solely by the president. Any chance that any of this lost military aid is in the hands of the enemies of the United States? Is the U.S. the supplier of its own terrorists? Churches worldwide opposed to war against Iraq. That's the headline from an article in Le Monde out of France on 15 October. You might not have heard this on television nor read it in the Prince George Citizen Fish Wrap. In the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas formulated the doctrine of a just war. Most Christian churches have accepted this ever since. According to this concept, a war is justified only if in response to an act of aggression and as a means of restoring international law and order. There must be a proportionality between the provocation and the response, the foreseeable damage, and the injustice that needs to be repaired. Now, the vast majority of Christian churches say that Bush's rationalizations for an attack on Iraq do not constitute the elements of a just war. The National Council of Churches, which includes about 50 Christian denominations, has implored Bush not to make war on Iraq. It looks like the only Christians to stand by with Bush Jr. in his pissing contest against Hussein are the fundamentalist Yahoos. Unfortunately, if this coming adventure sparks the feared confrontation of Islam against Christianity, we will all pay the price, Yahoos and thinkers alike. Here's an item from the Good Morning Prince George Flyer. I will abbreviate this item. Some time ago, the Sultan of Brunei had a single son and heir. He doted on this boy who was the light of his life. Just before the boy's 8th birthday, the Sultan took him aside and said, "Son, you bring so much happiness into my life that I will buy you anything you like for your birthday." The boy thought for a minute and said, "Father, I would like to be able to watch cartoons." Not wanting to do anything halfway, the Sultan bought his son the Walt Disney Studios and its string of movie theaters. The boy was able to watch his favorite cartoons to his heart's content. Just before the boy's 9th birthday, the Sultan took him aside again and told him, "Son, you are an inspiration to us all. Tell me what you want for your birthday and I will buy it for you." The boy thought of the pleasure he had found in the Disney cartoons and said to the Sultan, "Father, I would like a Mickey Mouse outfit." Not wanting to do anything halfway, the Sultan went to Penticton and bought him the BC Liberal Party. As a joke, that was not bad, but the Liberal Party is no joke for those of us who are not rich, and the party is not for sale. It has already been purchased by the millionaires and the corporations. The party is doing an admirable job of doing their bidding. We all know of the cuts to hospitals, schools, environmental protection, and the regulation that its friends call red tape. But that red tape to the rich is the framework of protections that shield us from the unscrupulous and the criminals who would poison and rob us of our environment. The civil servants who have overseen the protections are being cast off like garbage. Now the party is rewriting the Forest Practices Code with the help of their forestry friends, giving them freedom to exploit and destroy the forests that belong to all of us. Just as the new code is being changed, some 700 of the people who watch over our forest resources are fired. This is no coincidence, and this is happening across the board, not just to forestry, all over our province. This party of parasites rode to power on a wave of revulsion at the excesses of the new Democrats, who have a lot to answer for themselves. But the liberals, and I choke when I use that word which has such a rich history, on these creeps, came to power with another agenda than that which they professed. It is clear now that they are clearing the path for their corporate sponsors to operate without restraint in exploiting us as consumers, employees, and owners of this goddamn province. Before their mandate is over, we can expect not only to see those government functions that made life here worthwhile and peaceful destroyed, but we will have to watch as these parasites sell off our crown assets to their friends. These 77 members of the Legislative Assembly are not politicians. They're pirates, here to loot the public treasures and leave us with their debts. Gordon Campbell and his band of brigands are here to destroy, and no fancy talk can cover that up. The sooner they retreat back under the rocks from which they came, the sooner we can pick up the pieces of this great province and make sure that no such scourge as these liberals ever infest our political scene again. United States Senator Paul Wellstone is dead. This Democratic senator was a liberal from the days when liberal was not a synonym for shameless corporate ripoff artist. He died a timely death from the viewpoint of George Bush and his criminal cohorts in a small plane crash. He held the balance between a Democratic and Republican-controlled Senate. His death was not unlike that of Doug Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the United Nations, whose plane went down under mysterious circumstances in 1961. Doug had done an admirable work in trying to prevent the United States from taking control of the United Nations. The CIA was suspected in his death. Not that I would imply in any way that Bush's supporters offed Wellstone. Shit happens. In a tight race for control of the United States Senate, Bush wanted very much to put a Republican in Wellstone's Minnesota seat so he could have a majority in that body to rubber stamp his plans for the American empire. Well, yesterday he did it. Now there is a court challenge over the absentee ballots in yesterday's race because Wellstone received a lot of votes on those ballots. And there is a law in Minnesota that dead people are prohibited from running for office. It makes sense to me. If British Columbia had a law prohibiting the dead from running for MLA, we could disqualify most of the liberals currently holding seats here for re-election. Most of these members have shown no vital signs when it comes to protecting their constituents from the depredations of one Gordon Campbell. Campbell calls for public-private partnerships, P3. I prefer to think of P3 as meaning pilfering public property. When we look at the records of other jurisdictions and their experiences with P3, they don't look very good. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania turned the running of 20 of their most troublesome high schools over to a corporation called Edison Schools, Incorporated. In return for $881 U.S. per pupil per year, Edison promised to provide computers, textbooks, and new curricula while improving student performance. Are you ahead of me on this one? Well, Edison Schools was a victim of the stock market bubble, and it has collapsed. The computers and texts, lab supplies, and musical instruments have been seized by creditors, and the company is scrambling to run the schools with decades-old texts and almost no supplies. The stock has dropped from over $20 per share down to pennies as they scramble to save money. They even moved their corporate headquarters from a lavish office building to one of the high schools until the local school board kicked them out. I expect that some, if not all, of Campbell's planned P3 schemes will come to a bad end, but not until his corporate friends have looted the vaults. Watch to see what happens as Campbell turns our provincially owned assets over to his corporate friends. Remember, just as the undertakers clean up after the errors of the doctors, the lawyers clean up the messes of the preachers. This is Uncle Don, the direst of circumstances, with Uncle Don Reads the Comics on CFUR 88.7 in Prince George. Send threatening letters to Uncle Don, care of CFUR, 3333 University Way, Prince George, B.C., V2N4Z9. America's for-profit secret army. This is the headline of the latest morsel sent by my former roommate in New York City. This is from the New York Times of 13 October in the Money and Business section. This lengthy article tells how the Pentagon and state departments in the United States are increasingly hiring private contractors to provide functions that previously were provided by soldiers. Since the first Gulf War, the number of active duty American military personnel has fallen by a half million, but the number of contractors has risen by an undetermined number. These contracts are secret, and even Congress cannot find their extent. Contractors can be used to train the soldiers of military dictatorships and other situations where deniability is desired. Sorry, we don't have any soldiers operating there. Not our responsibility. We are innocent. Supposedly, these contractors avoid being classified as illegal combatants by not carrying weapons. Right. And Bill Clinton didn't inhale. We know that the U.S. what the U.S. does with illegal combatants. They ship them off to Guantanamo Bay. What do other countries do when they capture these American mercenaries? Again, the Americans can deny that these people exist and wash their hands of their fates. American mercenaries have been flying patrols in Colombia, training troops in the Balkans, and even teaching in American university and colleges with reserve officer training corps units. I can testify that the latter function, that of training college students in the acts of war, could be nothing but an improvement. When I was at my first university, I was required to take ROTC training. Every male was. This was a condition of federal funding, and the U.S. Army got the bulk of their officers from these training programs that went along with the other course curricula. It was a source of great annoyance to the professors in these institutions that Army sergeants, some without high school, were placed in the colleges and universities and given the title of Professor of Military Science and Tactics. Professor? Ye gods! In any case, the sergeants are gone and the mercenaries are in. They are now running the Army recruiting offices, too, bringing in the fresh meat with lies and inducements. Join the Army and see the world. Right. The point of this article is that the civilian control of the military is blurring. What used to be the subject of congressional oversight and control is now in the hands of the executive branch. Bush can now run his private wars without the knowledge of the legislative branch. Just another piece of the jigsaw puzzle that forms a picture of the President of the United States as effective emperor of the world. When I was stationed in the Panama Canal Zone, the Army was phasing out the ancient anti-aircraft guns that were supposed to protect us from invasion from the terrible Cubans, or Russians, or someone. In came bright, shiny Hawk missiles designed to be fired at enemy planes and to swoop down on them from above. The concept was fine, it was just the operation that lacked a bit in performance. These missiles were built by Raytheon Corporation, and their technicians, who I guess could be considered mercenaries, swarmed all over the place. I was a supply man in the local missile outfit for a brief period. I was privileged to witness a demonstration of the prowess of our new toys under the tutelage of our highly trained and highly paid technicians from the States. It was a gorgeous, clear day, and the trailers containing the hardware were arrayed on a pristine beach, ready to go. A radio-controlled drone circled high above, out of sight. The trailer with the spinning acquisition radar found its drone. The guidance radar on another trailer locked onto the target, and we could see it slowly move, following the drone. The trailer with four Hawk missiles moved in synchronization with the guidance radar. And suddenly, nothing happened. Our highly trained technicians rushed into the breach to find the source of the problem. There's a rule in electronics that says it works better if it is plugged in. The same applies to guided missiles. Someone had not plugged in the massive cables that connected two of the crucial trailers. The plug being inserted, the exercise began again. Another try, another failure. Technicians swarmed and soldiers snoozed when there was a great crash just offshore. The drone had run out of fuel and almost fell on us. Another drone was called in and the exercise resumed. Finally, the radar worked and a missile shot off into the blue with amazing speed. Nothing happened. It missed. After spending the better part of a day under ideal conditions, our fearless heroes managed to hit a drone. Success was declared and we retired to the barracks. Now, if the Soviets were to attack and patiently circle above us, we could eventually bring down the intruder. I think of this incident when I hear of the elaborate choreography that the Star Wars technicians have gone through to try to demonstrate that the anti-missile system works. It makes me feel safe. Canada issues travel advisory for rogue state travel. Our federal government has finally recognized that the United States of America might not be a healthy place for some Canadians to visit. For those of us who are in certain countries, the crossing of the border that used to be called the world's longest undefended border is not only an ordeal, but can be deadly. Recall the Canadian engineer born in Syria who was grabbed in New York when changing planes for Montreal. He was held incommunicado and then deported to Syria, where he faces torture and worse for leaving that country before doing his mandatory military service. Although he should have been deported to Canada, the Americans thumbed their noses at us and sent him to a country with a miserable human rights record. It could happen to any of us who were not born here. The paranoid American state now assumes that all people from the Middle East are terrorists until proven otherwise. Who's next? Last Friday, I listened to an interview with Pat Buchanan, a right-wing nut with a large following in the States. He had been referring to Canada as Canuckistan, and accuses our country of a variety of sins. As it happens, CBC's Evening Variety program called Buchanan and found him very candid. "We are a haven for terrorists. We are not carrying our share of the cost of defending North America. We whine about human rights and don't take the terrorism threat seriously," on and on. When he was questioned about the discriminatory treatment that some Canadians receive at the border, he acknowledged that and said if we don't like it, we should not visit the United States. He was quite clear he would be happy if we stayed on our side of the border. Sounds good to me. And we can go beyond that. Considering the appearance of the United States as a large lunatic asylum, we should take Pat's suggestion and stop visiting his paranoid air-conditioned nightmare. We could make it mutual by requiring that Americans have visas to cross headed north. It is statistically certain that more dangerous people head north than south across that border. The concept of dual citizenship for Canadian Americans should be ended. Our countries are too far apart in values for an individual to have loyalty to both. All dual nationals should be made to choose one citizenship or the other. This is not unprecedented. My father was born in the Panama Canal Zone of American parents who had immigrated from New Brunswick to complicate the mix, and he possessed dual citizenship until he was 21. At that age, he had to choose one or the other. We can do the same here. We can encourage Canadians and Americans to repatriate our investments. The exemption that allows Canadians to invest a portion of their RRSP money outside of the country could be repealed, forcing many billions of dollars to come back to our economy. Simultaneously, we could tax American investments here, prompting repatriation of those investments. A gradual divorce of the intertwined economies and social systems of our two countries would be, shall we say, to our mutual benefit. It's election time in Prince George. You can tell by the forests of signs all along the roads and public property telling us what? What does a sign saying "Elect Murphy" mean? Shortly after I came to Prince George, we had a provincial election. I was involved in a local political party at that time, and I participated in the campaign for that election. We had lots of campaign signs and volunteers to take them to people who wanted them on their lawns. In those days, the purpose of signs was to demonstrate a solidarity in a neighborhood and for a voter to announce where he or she stood. Now all the signs seem to be sprouting on public property, especially roadsides. What do they mean? They indicate to me that the candidates have nothing to say and no one who will let them put the signs on their property. The largest, fanciest, and most prolific signs tell me that they are sponsored by someone who has put money into the campaign and expects something back from that investment. During the last provincial election, there were a number of businesses that put out liberal signs. I remember the ones I saw, and I won't patronize their places of business. I know who my enemies are, and I don't feel obliged to make them any richer. Wait for the huge casino coming to Highway 16. Now we can expect the shabby casino that is located on George Street to relocate it to the lot across from the Superstore. Watch for a real gaudy joint to replace the casino now sandwiched into an old movie theater. This will be splashy because the owner has lots of money to throw around. There's been no shortage of suckers contributing to the cost of by donating their grocery money or that last paycheck. The last time that gambling joint moved, it increased in size much to the consternation of city council. Now it will be out of the downtown courts, so it will be accessible to the people who might have money left after their shopping at Costco or the Superstore. There will be plenty of parking on the premises and maybe even a used car buyer in-house. If you haven't blown your money in one of those ubiquitous kiosks that sell the lotto and scratch-and-lose tickets, you can go to a real casino and lose your money faster, maybe even your car. Hurry, suckers, big money to be won by those who bet their paycheck. There is still one born every minute. I've been to Las Vegas a few times, and I came out of the casinos ahead. I found a nickel on the floor of one. It was fascinating to watch the addicts at the slot machines, often feeding three machines at once, not waiting to see the results on one before feeding the next. It was fascinating and sad. It's a loser's sport. Some of the casinos had a special deal whereby they would cash a local paycheck without charge, and with each check cashed, the sucker got a spin of a huge wheel of fortune with a prize for everyone. Some were free meals, a box of candy, or a stack of chips. But those check cashing places were always at the back of the casino. To get out, the sucker had to pass the slot machines, the bars, the roulette wheel, and the crap tables, and all the rest. You think that even half of those workers ever made it to the street with their money? Las Vegas is a sad place and home to a pile of misery. I hate to see that duplicated here in Prince George. Democracy triumphs in Turkey. Much to the consternation of the U.S., this week's election in Turkey brought in a government with roots in Islam. Bush Light has planned to use bases in Turkey in his personal war against Saddam Hussein, but this may not happen now. If the Turkish generals, who have had three coups overthrowing government since 1960, allow democracy to peek through, Bush may have to make other plans. But Turkey may have a bit of a distance to go before it can claim to be a liberal democracy. It seems that the leader of the triumphant party, Mr. Erdogan, who is a former mayor of Istanbul, will not be allowed to become prime minister of Turkey since he has been a dangerous lawbreaker and a jailbird. According to the Globe and Mail, Mr. Erdogan did jail time for, quote, reading in public a poem that a court said was anti-secular, unquote. I don't think I would do well in Turkey. Hey, another bloody saint has been canonized. You've probably seen that the Pope has been canonizing dead folk left and right in a final flurry to give everyone in our new economy a patron saint. Largely unnoticed has been the recent recognition by the true church of the legendary John Henry as a saint. I don't know what miracles have been attributed to his intervention, but through an error in translation into Latin, John Henry is now the patron saint of car thieves. After all, he was a steel-driven man. You heard it first from Uncle Don. This concludes my Uncle Don show for the 6th of November. This is CFUR Radio, campus-based community radio in Prince George at 88.7 FM. Remember that good advice is expensive. Bad advice is also expensive.